Turn back to Colossians, if you haven't already, for the scripture reading. 15 through 20 is our text, and it is a beautiful one. In fact, this is my subjective opinion. I think it's the most beautiful part of this letter. A lot of people say about this part of the letter that it was an early Christian hymn. Some people say that at the very least it is early Christian poetry, maybe written by Paul or somebody else. But regardless, it is one that exposes the heart of what the gospel message is all about, because it's all about Jesus and who Jesus is. So we're told in just soaring language the majesty of the King that we serve and what He's like. And what we get out of this section is that because Jesus' power and His plans and His love are absolute, what more do we need? You could recall from the intro sermon, Paul writes the book of Colossians to a group of Christians who are struggling with ideas, or may be exposed to ideas down the road from people who say, Jesus is great, but Jesus isn't quite enough. You need to get circumcised. You need to follow the law of Moses. You need to go to a cave for a while. You need to think about visions that you might get and what those mean. And Colossians is written to say, no, Jesus is all. And therefore, He's all that you need. So there's a lot we can get out of this and learn. But let's look at this step by step. I think there's four different parts of this beautiful poetry for us to think about. And the first is in the first couple of verses in 15 and 16 there in chapter 1. He is the visible creator of all. And the word all in the original language is used 8 different times in these verses. So you're going to see that a lot. He's the visible creator of all. It is amazing to describe a human being as the picture of God when God consistently throughout Scripture is not seen. You remember even back in Exodus, Moses, the friend of God. And we're told Moses got to speak with God as a man speaks with his friend. Even Moses was told, you can't see me, you can't handle that, you're not allowed for that, because you would melt. I mean, you would be destroyed if I fully unveiled myself to you. But Jesus, in addition to being the perfect mediator in terms of delivering us from sin, is also the perfect picture of what God does really actually look like. You can look at Jesus and perfectly see God in Him. And there are all kinds of passages that back this up. John 1:18, no one has ever seen God, but the only God who is at the Father's side, Jesus, He has made Him known to us. John 14, when Jesus is getting ready to go to the cross and He's talking to His guys, one of the last conversations they have is Philip just pipes up and says, hey, can you show us the Father? If you could do that, that'd be enough for us. And Jesus says, I've been with you this whole time and you're saying stuff like that to me. Do you understand that if you've seen me, you have seen the Father? John 14:8-9. Remember the book of Hebrews? The very third verse of the book of Hebrews says that Jesus is the exact imprint, the radiance of the glory of God, the exact imprint of His nature. You know, when we talk about fathers and sons, in the way that we think about things today, we often talk about family resemblances, don't we? We often talk about, well, the apple didn't fall far from the tree with that guy. When you look at his dad and you look at his son, boy, you see they look alike in their body structure or their face, or they, you know, they're doing the same kind of job or they're or whatever. You know, when you look at my dad, many of you have met my dad. He is 6'2", just like I am 6'2". I'm told that my grandfather Combs was 6'2", and his dad was. So being 6'2", is just kind of baked into the Combs men genes. That's just what we do. I'd be curious to see what Ezra and Isaiah do. But that's just kind of who we are. But we realize, even with family resemblance, none of us are carbon copies of any other person on the planet. All of us, just scientifically, just on a basic kind of level, we all have different DNAs. We are different people in different kinds of ways, even when there's some overlap. But when you study the scriptures, and you look at the Father, and you look at the Son of the Father, they have the exact same nature. And all of them are perfectly united, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, in terms of their plans, in terms of the work that they do. Because this is one of the clearest passages in Scripture that tells us that Jesus was the creator of the heavens and the earth. Not just the Father, not just the Spirit hovering over the face of the waters in Genesis 1. Jesus was creator as well, working alongside of the Father and the Spirit. So look what he says here in verse 15. He is the firstborn of all creation. That doesn't mean that, as some would suggest, that he was the first to be created. Now, the Father just said, hey, I want a son. Boom, there's Jesus. That's not how it happens. Jesus is eternal, just as the Father was eternal. But this is firstborn of creation in the sense that he ranks above the creation. And he predates the creation. Before any of us or any of this, there was Jesus and God and the Spirit. Just as if you're talking about a carpenter, he predates and he ranks above the tables and the chairs that he makes in his workshop. None of us would ever confuse those pieces of furniture with him. There is no comparison to that. One has made the other. All things. Did you notice how it says, it doesn't leave anything out in verse 16. In him all things were created. So, some people ask, where does the devil come from? Verse 16 explains that question. Not that God created the devil or evil spirits as evil. They chose that direction themselves. He creates all things good. But even those spirits that are now actively working against him in the spiritual places, in the heavenly places, they have their origin in Jesus. That is an amazing thought. So when those demons that he casts out go into the pigs, when the demons leave the bodies of the people that he's working with, when he talks about binding up Satan, when he talks about crushing the serpent, he made those spirits. He's the visible creator of all. Not only is he the agent of creation, he is also the goal of creation. Did you notice all of the different prepositional phrases here? I think it's interesting, in the last line of the Gettysburg Address that President Lincoln spoke, that we're very familiar with, remember how Mr. Lincoln said that our government in the United States was of the people, by the people, for the people, and we want to make sure that it doesn't perish from the earth? Well, Paul says that the creation was made by Jesus, through Jesus, and for Jesus. And I appreciated when Billy read that passage a minute ago, he emphasized that. I don't know if you caught that in the way that he read that. This was made, at the end of verse 16, through him and for him. Isn't that interesting? So we are supposed to be impressed by black holes and icebergs and iguanas and giraffes, and all the different things that we can see on the planet and in the heavens. But this world is not made for us. We are supposed to be living as impressed humans, but also fearful, with the understanding that we are pitching our tents on somebody else's property. We often sing, this is my Father's world. This is not just my Father's world. This is also Jesus's world, because he made it. He owns it. He has crafted it. And we need to recognize that. He is the visible creator of all things. He is also the foremost sustainer of all things. And you get that in the part of the poem of verse 17. He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. Did you know that in the early days of our country, a lot of people believed in God, a lot of people read their Bibles, but a lot of people subscribed to this religious philosophy called deism, which is basically the idea that God set everything up. You know, He set this giant globe spinning in the heavens, and He put everything together, and then He just kind of sat back and watched. And He just kind of withdrew Himself and took a seat on the throne and let everything else happen the way that it happens. But what Paul is suggesting to us here in verse 17 is the opposite idea. That everything about our world, it wasn't just set up and God left it and went and just did something else or took a nap or something. He is actively involved even this very second in the creation. Every molecule in your body, every time you take a breath, every time you walk down the road, or you drive your car, or you go to work, you do anything, that is only because He is actively holding all of you together. And all of us can say that. Everything in the world is held together by this King of Kings and Lord of Lords. That is a humbling thought. You know, those of us in our American Western culture, we're trained to resist the idea of absolute dictatorships. You know, have you ever read George Orwell, 1984? Maybe high school, you had to do a paper on it or something. You're like, yeah. it's not the most lovey-dovey, uplifting book. But there are books like that because we as Westerners are like, we don't want Big Brother to be watching us. We don't want this organized central leadership from on high looking at us through our television screens and making sure that we do all the things that the higher-ups want us to do. We want to be independent. We want to do our own thing. We want to live our own life and say our own words and think our own thoughts. But if you think about it from a scriptural perspective, that's not the way it is spiritually or any other way in our life, because the King of all kings is. He's not a big brother in that kind of sense, but He is our absolute Lord. He is watching everything that we do. He is holding us all together. But He is not one of these governments that we're afraid of on a human level. He is ruling us with absolute love and wisdom, unlike a Hitler or a Stalin or a Putin or anybody else who says, I want control of all of you and I want to put you under my thumb. That's not the Lord that we serve. But He is an absolute Lord. And He is always, at every moment, carrying forward His plan to sustain His people, us, and bring the creation to the new creation from where it sits now. Which is, as we often say, a broken world. There's one of my favorite passages in Isaiah in chapter 64 where Isaiah the prophet just gets really exasperated and he cries out to God toward the end of the book, and he just says, Isaiah 64:1, "Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down like you did at Mount Sinai. That you would just tear open the sky and you would descend so that everybody can just look up like they did at that mountain and see the fire and the billowing smoke and say, yep, there's God right there. And be amazed by that." But you know, God was doing that all along. And when Jesus came, remember what happened at His baptism? Mark chapter 1 in verse 10 says this, that when Jesus came up out of the water, the heavens were torn. They were rent asunder, and God did. the Spirit came down in the form of like a dove, and God's voice spoke and said, "That's my Son. He's the one that you've been waiting for to do all the things that you wanted the Messiah to do. He's it." So even when it looks like God is absent, He is always active and present in our lives. Even when we go through sickness and we don't get better the next week. Even when a loved one passes away and we don't know how we're going to get through the next month. Even when, he's always holding and sustaining and helping through anything that we go through in this life so that his new creation can come. And that is a comfort. Something else that we see in the first part of verse 18. Look at this. He is the head of the body, the church. So he is the undisputed leader of all of his people. So the first part of the poem, when we looked at 15 and 16 and 17, all of that is dealing with the creation in terms of what we're living in, what we're experiencing now, our lives now here. But what verse 18 is starting to approach is the new creation that is coming, that Jesus came here to usher in and inaugurate and take us all to someday. So he's talking about the church. This is the new creation, the form of all of his people. So just like our heads regulate and control what our body does, the movements of our limbs, and what happens inside of our bodies on all kinds of scales. It's just what the head does. I mean, we're still studying the brain today. We don't completely understand the brain even now. But it does all kinds of things to help our bodies to function the way that they should. So just like that is happening with our bodies, Jesus is the one who is doing that for all of us, all of his people. You know, although we like to think of ourselves as independent beings, none of us actually are. We are completely dependent on what Jesus does for us. Can you imagine if your arm just said, you know, I'm sick of being an arm connected to the rest of you, and I'm just going to take a vacation, and, you know, I'll be on a Zoom call if you need me over here. You know, how silly would that be? There's no way that that arm can do anything unless it is connected to the body and specifically the head to tell it to wave and grasp and do all the things that hands and arms do. That's exactly the position that we are in. Heads are extremely important, and that's why, not to get too gory, but if you want to end somebody else's life, cutting off their head is a really good, effective, efficient way of ending their entire life. And that's what the French did in their revolution. So because of all this, it's pretty silly for any of us as members of this body, we are not the head of, to creep up the ladder and try to usurp the throne of the one who sits there. None of us are the leaders of God's people. But ever since Jesus started gathering followers, this has been an issue for Jesus' people. Do you remember the apostles had a constant argument with each other about who is the greatest? Well, I think it's me for X, Y, and Z reasons. Because last night, Jesus said some things to me that maybe he didn't say to you. Or, I think it's me because, you know, I went into that room and he didn't take you. Or, I went on a mountain and I saw things that he said I couldn't even talk about with you guys. You know, all kinds of silliness happened. But that same silliness still happens today among some of God's people. Do you remember also when John wrote his last letter of 3 John, before he wrote the book of Revelation, he mentions a guy who couldn't care less about what he wrote. Only one chapter in 3 John. 3 John verse 9, I've written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to be first, but put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. And so what he's doing is, not only is he rejecting what the apostles are saying, he's kicking out people from the church who have visited from other places, and instead of accepting them as brothers, he feels threatened by them and wonders about his authority, so he's rejecting them. He's trying to set himself up in these shoes. And that it can be a danger for all of us if we're not careful. Because practically speaking, we need to be humble about how we interpret the Bible and how we relate together. And we need to be not fearful of listening to alternative arguments. When somebody says, this is how I'm reading the Bible, and somebody else in the congregation says, well, this is how I'm reading the Bible, we need to listen to that other person. And if ever we get to a point in our work together where somebody just gets up and says something and nobody is interested in questioning it or considering the best alternative argument, then we are in trouble because we are accepting somebody as this position when he has no right to be there. None of us are the ultimate interpreters of any passage of Scripture or regulators of how our religion should work and how we should relate to each other. That position alone belongs to the King of Kings, who has made all things, who sustains all things, and is the head alone of his people. There are no two heads, or three heads, or four. That's only monsters in cartoons that work that way. Real bodies just have the one, and that's Jesus. So that's verse 18, the first part of verse 18, but look at the rest of the poem. From the middle part of verse 18 to verse 20 presents the idea that Jesus is the resurrected reconciler of all of those who are his. Notice how it says specifically, Jesus is the firstborn of the dead. So in the beginning, it talks about the firstborn of creation. Now he's the firstborn of the dead, which doesn't mean he's the very first one to be resurrected from the dead. Because you can even look in the Old Testament, you can see Elijah and Elisha going into rooms with dead bodies, and the power of the Lord raises those people from the dead. You can also look at Jesus' ministry. Before he even went to the cross, he was going into rooms with dead bodies and doing the same thing. He raised Jairus' daughter from the dead. He raised Lazarus from the dead when he walked over to the tomb and said, hey, get out. And he did. He raised a widow's son from the city of Nain. So he did those kinds of things. It may have even done more than we know about. But his resurrection ranks above all of the other ones. Because, number one, as sometimes we'll say, he was the first to raise to never die again. But also, his resurrection is really what made all the other ones possible. All the ones from the Old Testament, and also the ones to come. All of us are really counting on that promise to be true. And the reason why we can have confidence in that promise now is because of what he did to come out of the tomb himself. Something else that you'll notice about this in what Paul says here in the poem is that the fullness of God, because of what he is and what he's done, the fullness of God dwells within him. See that? That's really neat because this reminds us of a lot of Old Testament passages that mention God filling up the physical spaces that his people constructed for him. That happens at when the tabernacle is built. The glory of the Lord fills it up, and they can't even go into the room to offer the sacrifices that they need to offer because there's a bunch of smoke in there. God moved in to his house. Same thing happens with the temple. Solomon builds the temple. Glory of the Lord moves in. But we understand that that was just symbolic. That God didn't actually move into that little bitty space of blocks and wood and leather coverings. You know, because Solomon even says, heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, how much less this little house that I have built. God can't fully dwell in those things, but God can fully dwell inside of his Son. Jesus was the temple that Solomon's house and the tabernacle never could be, never could accomplish fully. And that's why he can fully dwell inside of us, his people. Because of the sacrifice that he made, he can restore things that never were restored before and renew what is broken. Because of the terrible act of unjust violence that was perpetrated on him, he can usher in this time of peace for the rest of us. Did you see that? Verse 20? He reconciles all things to himself, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. Ever since Eden, we've been waiting for that peace. And if you go to the Ephesian letter in chapter 1, verse 10, it mentions that the whole plan of God is to unite all things together. Things in heaven, things on earth, and bring the new creation to fruition and us with it. And unlike the plans of man, which may or may not happen, this plan is proceeding right on schedule, and it's bound any day now, any time now, any minute now, it's going to happen. And it's going to be completed. So he is the resurrected reconciler of all. And so the overall point that we get out of this is that his plans, his power, his love, they are absolute. You cannot look at Jesus and say, well, you're really good at this, and you're really powerful in this kind of way, but you don't have this. This is a missing piece, like you can with all of us. All of us. You can look and see, well, some good things, but we're mixed bags. We are mixed bags, all of us, because we're continually being completed, and God is working in us to grow us more and more and more until we finally, at the end of all days, look exactly like Him. But that day is not now. And so we got to be patient with each other as we work toward that day. But here's the question I want to leave us with. If Jesus is all this, what more do we need for personal satisfaction than what He can give us? You ever think in your life, well, I would really be fulfilled if I just had this thing over here. If I had more money, and if I had these things that money could buy, I would be more happy. Or if I had more talents than God gave me, or I had different talents than the ones He gave me, then I would be more fulfilled. Or if I had a different church that I was a part of, or if it was composed of different people, or somehow things were altered, then I would be more happy. Or if I had this special relationship, this special guy or this special girl, then I would be happy. Or if I had more pats on the back, I would be more happy. We could just fill in the blank with all kinds of things or people. And just base our commitment to the Lord on those things. When we already have Jesus at the center, He's saying, I'm it. I am all there is. And if you have me, you are fulfilled. And you are exactly who you need to be. You have what you need to have. And there's no doubt that there are certain blessings in our lives that if we had them, it would make life more comfortable than they are now, maybe. And maybe you could make a list of those. But every blessing in this life carries its own unique set of challenging circumstances, because every good blessing that we can have, any one of them, whether it's relationships or recognition or whatever it is, they're all tinged by sin because we're in the life we are now. And that's why we need to truly fill up, not with possessions or anything else, earthly relationships, earthly recognitions. We need Him. We need Jesus of Nazareth to be the one that gives us all things that we require. So, do you need Him this morning? I think it's pretty clear from this text that we've been studying that there's no doubt that He fills all things. He's made all things. He is currently holding all things together. He is bringing forward His plan to restore all things to an even better situation than Adam and Eve experienced at the beginning of Genesis. He's going to do those things. There's no question about that. But the only question is, do you want to become part of that beautiful plan that He is bringing forward to the end of time. For thousands of years, there have been people who have said, yes, I want to be part of that. And they have reaped blessings that those of us here who have said yes before are glimpsing and taking advantage of currently even now in our lives. And so much more so when that final day comes. So if you want to say yes to Jesus today, even for the first time, or you need to come back to Him, please let us know how we can help you as we stand up, we sing the invitation song that Herb selected for us.